Chapter 20. The Text of the Protocols. The following is an abridgment of the 24 protocols. In summarizing them, much had to be left out. The ideas expressed are implicitly those of the Jews themselves, not mine. We should keep in mind that these protocols were written at least 70 years ago and formulated centuries earlier. Protocol number 1. This protocol is a concentrated treatise on the ABCs of political power. It deals with all the naive fantasies about democracy, about self-determination, and many other illusions that we have cherished over all these years, and depicts them as a mere sham. It contends that political freedom is an idea only, but never an actual fact. The idea of freedom can be used as a bait to attract the masses of the people to one's party for the sole purpose of crushing another party who is in power. The conclusion is drawn that, by the law of nature, right lies in force and right lies in might. It is pointed out that the blind might of a nation cannot for one single day exist without guidance. In order to grasp this power, the task is rendered easier if the opponent has himself been infected with the idea of freedom or so-called liberalism, and for the sake of an idea, it is willing to yield some of his power. In any case, the whole idea of self-government is a hoax and a fraud, and has been used as an illusion wherewith to capture the mobs, who, when left to their own devices, invariably end up in havoc. Anarchy is something that the Jew promotes relentlessly. While in complete control of the financial powers of the state, they promote internecine strife, which they soon aggravate into battles between classes, in the midst of which states burn down and their importance is reduced to that of a heap of ashes. When a state has been exhausted itself in its own convulsions, whether its internal discord brings it under the power of external foes, or by civil warfare, it can then, in any case, be accounted as irretrievably lost and in the power of the Jews. They then rationalize that there is nothing immoral about using trickery, cunning, treachery, or any other device to bring a state within their power. They say, after all, if a state is fighting an external enemy, they will use the same means of treachery, cunning, deceit, or any other device in order to win a war and overcome that enemy state. Therefore, what is the difference about waging war internally against that state if the powers that stand in their way are their enemies? They then go on to show that despotism is the only possible kind of government. The mob is a blind man, a blind force without possible leadership. If a leader emerges from the mob, he has no program. He has no idea of the principles of political guidance. There is no possible success of guiding these crowds by the aid of reasonable counsels and arguments. For any objection, a contradiction, senseless though it may be, can be made. Such senseless objection may find more favor with the people than reason. The people's powers of reasoning are, after all, purely superficial. Masses are guided solely by petty passions, paltry beliefs, customs, traditions, and sentimental theorism. As a result, they fall prey to party dissensions, which hinders any kind of agreement, even on the basis of a perfectly reasonable argument. Politics has nothing to do with morals. Any ruler who is governed by morals is an unskilled politician, and therefore is very vulnerable and unstable on his throne. Anyone who wishes to rule must have recourse to both cunning and to deceit. The result justifies the means. Therefore the Jews say, their intentions are directed not to what is good and what is moral, but to that which is necessary and useful. They therefore contend that no people is capable of ruling itself, that thinks they can rule with the common consent of the majority, and for the good of all. They have therefore trained their own men from childhood for independent rule, who understand the mechanics of ruling mobs and ruling nations. It is unthinkable, they say, for the mob to rule themselves. For a plan broken up into as many parts as there are heads in the mob loses all homogeneity, and thereby becomes unintelligible and impossible of execution. Consequently, they point out that the only means of government is by the application of the leadership principle. The conclusion is inevitable that a satisfactory form of government for any country is one that is concentrated in the hands of a responsible person. Without an absolute despotism, there can be no existence for civilization, which is carried on not by the masses, but by their leader, whosoever that person may be. The mob is a savage and displays savagery at every opportunity. They therefore feel that without a doubt, they are entitled to rule not only one nation, but all nations, and that they must not stop at bribery, deceit, and treachery, when they should serve towards the attainment of their ends. Their countersign is force and make-believe. Rather than conquer states by force of arms, they want to march along the path of peaceful conquest, and replace the horrors of war by less forceful and more satisfactory sentences of death, which they deal out to anyone who stands in their way of grabbing power. In fact, they place great emphasis on the necessity of maintaining the terror which tends to produce blind submission. Just but merciless severity is the greatest factor in the strength of the state. By the doctrine of severity, we shall triumph and bring all government into subjection to our super-government. They admit that already, far back in ancient times, they, the Jews, were the first to cry among the masses of the people the words, liberty, equality, and fraternity. They have used these words, or their equivalent, innumerable times since, and have had them repeated by stupid parrots, who from all sides flew down upon these baits, and with them carried away the well-being of the world, carried away the true freedom of the individual, which formerly was so well guarded against the pressures of the mob. They point out that the Goyim did not note the contradiction of the meaning of these words, and did not see that in nature there is no equality, there cannot be freedom, that nature herself has established inequality of minds, of characters and capacities, just as immutably as she has established subordination of her laws. The Jews show that the white man, whom they call Goyim, has ruled through his nobility only by dynasties. In these, the father passed on to the son a knowledge of the course of political affairs, in such a way that none should know it but members of the dynasty, and none should know it but members of the dynasty, and none could betray it to those who were governed. As time went on, and the Jewish ideas of democracy penetrated further and further into the thinking and government of the white people, the true position of the ruling dynasties became confused, and their political skills were lost. This was a great aid to the success of the Jewish cause in taking over these nations. Therefore, in shouting the words liberty, equality, and fraternity, they brought to the Jewish ranks, thanks to their own agents, whole legions who bore their banners with enthusiasm. All the time, these words were cankerworms at work, boring into the well-being of the Goyim, putting an end everywhere to peace, quiet, solidarity, and destroying all the foundations of the Goyim states. The Jews show that their triumph was rendered much easier by the fact that in their relations with the men whom they wanted to have, they always worked upon the most sensitive chords of the human mind, namely, upon their lust for money, upon their stupidity, and upon the insatiability of material needs of men. Whereas each of these human weaknesses, taken alone, is sufficient to paralyze initiative, taken together, it hands over, lock, stock, and barrel, the will of men to the disposition of those who have been paid for their treachery and treason. By using the power of their gold, their financial forces, and by using cunning, deceit, and treachery, they have made it possible to replace the representatives of the people and put in their place, instead, their lackeys and their agents. Protocol number 2. The Jews herein reveal the tremendous importance of instigating and waging economic wars and military wars between the Goyim states. Wars have been referred to as the Jewish harvest. It is by means of wars that the Jews reap and lay the foundations of Jewish predominance. When the wars are over, both sides are devastated and at the mercy of international Jewish finance. They say, our international rights will wipe out national rights. While wiping out huge assets, laying waste large sections of both sides of the Gentile nations, when the war is over, both sides find themselves in financial distress and overwhelmingly in debt. Thus we find the Jews reaping a threefold harvest from wars. First, they make a huge profit from munitions manufacturing and other financial sinews of war. Secondly, they are therewith able to weaken the racial stamina of the white race by sending forth into battle the flower of manhood of the white nations of both sides. Thirdly, when the war is over and both sides are prostrate, the Jews then further ensnare the Gentile nations by chaining them with huge indebtedness and collecting interest upon interest. Thereby the white nations and the white race are further ensnared into bondage, and the Jewish stranglehold is progressively tightened. The Jews then boast how they choose Goyim administrators for public office, people who will front for them, and whose loyalty as stooges they can count upon. Naturally, these will be people who are willing to be traitors to the white race, and who know very little about the art of government. Back of these lackeys will be their own Jewish advisers, who they claim are men of learning and genius, specially bred and reared from early childhood to rule the affairs of the whole world. The last part tells about the powerful part played by the press in the hands of the Jews. Through the press, we have gained the power to influence, while remaining ourselves in the shade. Thanks to the press, we now have the gold in our hands, notwithstanding that we have had to gather it out of the oceans of blood and tears. They sum it up by saying that the triumph of the Jewish system will fail of success if the practical application of it is not based upon a summing up of the lessons of the past in the light of the present. Thus we see the gathering of the reins of power into the hands of the Jews by their treacherous devices. These are by the use of wars, by plunging the ravaged nations into indebtedness, by the control of stooges to front in positions of power, by the skillful use of the press to keep pointing our requirements are supposedly indispensable, to give voice to the complaints of the people, to express and create discontent, and last but not least, the power of gold. Protocol number 3. With overbearing arrogance and supreme confidence, the Jews tell us that our goal is now only a few steps off. The old, long path we have trodden is now ready to close its cycle of the symbolic snake, by which we symbolize our people. When this ring closes, all the states of Europe will be locked in its coil, as in a powerful vice. They reveal further how they are going to lock us, the Goyim, in their powerful vice, whereas the Goyim think that they have constitutions that are sufficiently strong to keep the ship of state on an even keel. The Jews have our kings, rulers, and representatives surrounded with their advisers to advise them into one foolish, irresponsible move after another. By stirring up a host of confused issues, they increasingly widen the gulf between the rulers and the people. With the power of the press in the hands of the Jews, they encourage abuses of power by the rulers on the one hand, by agitating and stirring the mob up on the other hand. They will put the final touch in preparing all institutions for their overthrow, and everything will fly skyward under the blows of the maddened mob. In the meantime, by continually worsening and bringing about financial and economic crises, all the people are chained down to heavy toil by poverty more firmly than they ever were chained by slavery and serfdom. Our power is in the shortness of food and physical weakness of the worker, because by all that this implies, he is made a slave for our will. Thereby, they further promote the hate and the envy that will move the mobs to turn upon those and wipe out all those who are an obstacle in the way of the Jews and their takeover of power. When the hour strikes for our sovereign lord of all the world, in other words, the Jewish dictator, to be crowned, it is these same hands which will sweep away everything that might be a hindrance thereto. As these mobs then rage and destroy, the Jews have made sure that they will not touch their property, because the moment of attack will be known to the Jews only, and they will be prepared to take measures to protect their own. They frankly admit that they engineered the French Revolution, and that the secrets of its preparations were well known to them, for it was wholly the works of our hands. They mock the word freedom, saying that it means absolutely nothing, but is a useful tool for them to use to inflame the mobs and bring out whole communities of men to fight against every kind of force, against every kind of authority. The mobs, under the Jews' control, will then kill the last vestiges of Gentile leadership and acquit the criminals, so that in the end, the mob will unwittingly help the Jews to enthrone the king despot of the blood of Zion, whom we are preparing for the world. Protocol number 4. Here the Jews reveal to us frankly that they have organized Gentiles into Masonic orders, which are one of their most powerful tools for controlling the world and for driving the Gentile states into destruction for their total Jewish takeover of the world. Gentile masonry blindly serves as a screen for us and our objects. But the plan of action of our force, even its very abiding place, remains for the whole people an unknown mystery. To further move the conspiracy to its ultimate conclusion, it is necessary for the Jews to destroy all the foundations upon which the Goyim society has been built. They will furthermore keep the Goyim so busy earning a living that he will have no time to think or take note of what is going on. While the Goyim is working and earning a living and pursuing industry and trade, the Jew will be pursuing a speculation. This will result in everything that is produced from the land or by industry to slip through their hands and pass into speculation and pass into the hands of the Jews. Having destroyed all moral principles among the Gentiles, that is the white people, having turned their minds completely towards industry and trade and earning a living, they will bring them to a stage where their only guide is gain, that is gold, which they will erect into a veritable cult for the sake of those material delights which it can give, not even to win wealth, but solely out of hatred towards the privileged. The lower classes of the Goyim will follow our lead against our rivals for power, the intellectuals of the Goyim, in order to destroy them. Again, the stupidity of the Goyim will be used to destroy their own. Protocol number 5. Creation of an intensified centralization of government. Methods of seizing power by masonry, causing the impossibility of agreement between states. The state of predestination of the Jews, gold the engine of the machinery of the states, significance of criticism, show institutions, wariness from word spinning, how to take a grip of public opinion, significance of personal initiative, the supergovernment. Protocol number 6, the establishment of huge Jewish financial monopolies containing reservoirs of colossal riches is hereby spelled out. These monopolies will be so powerful that the fortunes of any Gentile will depend upon them to such an extent that the non-Jewish fortunes will not be able to exist outside the control and manipulation of these Jewish monopolies. Today we see these as an established fact, no matter what business you look into, whether it be oil, sugar, movies, television networks, steel, railways, automobile manufacturing, and 100 other lines of endeavor, they are all in the hands of the Jews. While they are garnering all the riches of the land into huge Jewish monopolies, they will still say that in every possible way they must develop the significance of their supergovernment by representing it as the protector and benefactor of all those who voluntarily submit to them. The next section deals with the means of depriving the Goyim of their land, and they say frankly, this must be done, whatever the cost. The best way to bring this about is to load land and property with debts, and thereby keep it in a state of humble, continuous, and unconditional submission. A further way to deprive the white people of their hard-earned money and property is first and foremost for the Jews to engage in speculation and monopolize it. In this way, they drain off from industry and from labor and capital and from the land and transfer into Jewish hands all the money of the world. Then the Goyim will bow down to us, if for no other reason but to get the right to exist. In order to bring further ruin to the Goyim, they will promote and encourage by propaganda a greedy demand for luxury, which will swallow up any earnings that they might have left over. We shall raise the rate of wages, which, however, will not bring any advantage to the workers, for at the same time, we shall produce a rise in prices of the first necessaries of life, alleging that it arises from the decline of agriculture. On top of this, they will further encourage and accustom workers to anarchy and to drunkenness. At the same time, they will take all measures possible to exterminate from the face of the earth all the educated forces of the Goyim. While they are doing all this, they will mask the heinous destruction of the white race under an alleged ardent desire to serve the working classes and the great principles of political economy. Protocol number 7. To back up and enforce all these vicious programs of economic strangulation of the Goyim, the Jews plan the intensification of armaments, the increase of police forces, and the sowing of ferment discord and hostility all over the world. When they get through, all that will be left in all the different countries of the world will be the masses of the proletariat, a few millionaires devoted to Jewish interests, and police and soldiers. By having Jewish agents in the governments of all the countries of the world, by economic treaties, by loan obligations, by the ferments and hostilities they have created, they will, with their intrigues, have so entangled all the threads of the governments of the world that none of them will be able to act without the Jews manipulating the levers of power. If any country dares to oppose them, the Jews will then collectively organize their neighbors in a joint venture to stand collectively together against that country and destroy that country by universal war. How frightful and real this power is was shown in World War II, when Germany, through courage and strength, shook off the Jew. Then immediately, through vicious propaganda, intrigue, financial means, and other levers of power, the Jews organized the surrounding neighbors into a beastly war of annihilation. This they can do because, as they say, we must compel the governments of the Goyim to take action in the direction favored by our widely conceived plan, already approaching the desired consummation by what we shall represent as public opinion, secretly promoted by us through the means of that so-called great power, the press, which, with a few exceptions that may be disregarded, is already entirely in our hands. Should Europe get out of their control, then the Jews are determined to show their strength by responding with the guns of America or China or Japan to smash Europe if necessary. Protocol number 8. The manipulation of the courts is herewith discussed. Their plan is to destroy the white man's courts of law and degrade and degenerate it into a legal jungle. Further, to hamstring and harass honest citizens, the Jews first of all plan to heavily staff the whole legal system with their own breed. If we look around us today, it is hardly possible to ignore how heavily Jew-infested our legal system is. The majority of the judges are Jews. The number of attorneys is heavily weighted with Jews. In order to bring about their contrived and perverted decisions and justify them to the public, they make it a fine science to cover their idiotic decisions with the most high-sounding, exalted moral principles passed into legal form. To train their breed of lawyers for all this intricate treachery and finagling, they have schools which prepare their selected personnel by a special super-educational training course in their special Jewish schools. With their special training, they will be made acquainted with the whole underside of human nature, with all its sensitive chords in which they will have to play. The Jews go heavily into the study of economics, not to clarify the issues, but the better therewith to confuse them. Around their government, that is the Jewish government, There will be a whole constellation of bankers, industrialists, capitalists, and above all, millionaires, because, as they say, everything will be settled by the question of money. The Jews will install Gentile stooges to head up government departments, but they will be people and persons whose past and reputation are such that have criminal involvement, people who have some dark, murky hidden past and are easily blackmailed. Such people never represent the interests of their own race, but are outright traitors to the white race, and this, as the Jews say, in order to make them defend our interests to their last gasp. Protocol number 9. The Jews make a full and detailed study of the character of the people of the country which they intend to destroy. By cautious application of this principle, you will see that a decade will pass before the most stubborn character will change, and we shall add new people to the ranks of those already subdued by us. They confide that the Masonic watchwords of liberty, equality, fraternity have been a powerful tool for the destruction of the different nations of the world. Whereas these words express a meaningless and impossible idealism, that is beside the point. It has been tremendously useful and has worked. A short discussion that then ensues about the use of artificially controlled antisemitism being tremendously useful to them for the management of our lesser brethren. In other words, controlled antisemitism is a very useful tool to unite and bring all the Jews in line in cooperation with their worldwide master plan. For the Jews, there are no checks or limits to the range of their activities. Their supergovernment is not limited by any laws or conditions. At the proper time, we the lawgivers shall execute judgment and sentence. We shall slay and we shall spare. We, as the head of all our troops, are mounted on the steed of the leader. They have enmeshed into their network the service of persons of all opinions, of all doctrines, demagogues, socialists, communists, and utopian dreamers of every kind. Each of them has been given a task. Each of them, on his own account, is boring away at the last remnants of authority, striving to overthrow all established forms of order. By these acts, all states are in torture, but we will not give them peace until they openly acknowledge our international supergovernment, and with submissiveness. Remembering that these protocols were written over 70 years ago, even then the Jews openly bragged that they already had in their hands the administration of the law, the conduct of elections, the press, the liberty of person, but above all, education and training of the young people. They further brag that they have fooled, used, and corrupted the youth of the Goyim by rearing them in the principles and theories which are known to the Jews to be false. They further openly brag that they have in the Western countries a means and a maneuver of such appalling terror that even the very stoutest hearts will quail. They have undergrounds called metropolitans, those subterranean corridors which, before the time comes, will be driven under all the capitals, and from whence those capitals will be blown into the air with all their organizations and archives. Protocol number 10. Illustrating how easy it is to fool the Goyim, the Jews state point blank that the people are perfectly content with the outside appearance of their governments and don't have the faintest understanding of the underlying meaning of things or the actions going on behind the scenes. In order to keep it that way, it is important that all questions ought not to be touched upon directly and openly before the people. By not naming a principle, the Jews leave themselves free for any action they choose. A political scoundrel, who is a rascal but clever, will be admired by the mob for his impudent audacity. The Jewish hierarchy has drawn up a master plan for erecting a new fundamental structure embracing all the nations of the earth, United Nations. They mean to bring all the peoples under their one despotic Jewish dictator by first subjecting the peoples of the world to such terrible suffering, confusion, and torment that they will throw up their hands in desperation. The Jews will then offer them the solution to all their problems by a coup d'etat that they will then bring about. They will set themselves on the throne of the world. Some of the tools for accomplishing this are to give everybody a vote without distinction of classes or without qualifications, by destroying among the Goyim the importance of the family and its educational value, by creating of the mob a blind, mighty force which will never be in a position to move in any direction without the guidance of the Jewish agents set at the head as leaders of the mob. The Jews are well aware of the leadership principle and have utilized it from the beginning of their history to bring them to the present state of power. They realize that a scheme of government must come ready-made from one brain and must not be split into fractional parts from the minds of the many. Whereas it is allowable for a select company of their hierarchy to have knowledge of the general scheme of action, they must not discuss the details, because it would destroy its artful design, the interdependence of its component parts, and the secret meaning of each clause. They take a very dim view of the usefulness of a constitution as a means of protecting the people from their conspiracy. They state openly, a constitution, as you well know, is nothing else but a school of discords, misunderstandings, quarrels, disagreements, fruitless party agitations, party whims, in a word, a school of everything that serves to destroy the personality of state activity. Democracies and republics, with everybody having a vote, down to the last scum and rabble, provides the Jew with the finest element with which to destroy the state and the people within the state. In order that they can best manipulate such a state, they arrange to elect presidents and other officials which have in their past some dark, undisclosed stain. These agents will then do their bidding without fear of any revelation on the part of the Jews. Finally, by means of creating discord, by plundering the people blind by taxation, by bungling, by a breakdown of law and order, by dissension, hatred, struggle, envy, and even by the use of torture, by starvation, by the inoculation of diseases, by want, finally, the people will be so exhausted and so desperate that they will see no other choice but to take refuge in the Jewish leadership. The people will submit and surrender to their unconditional Jewish sovereignty. Protocol number 11. The Goyim, white Gentiles, are a flock of sheep, and we are their wolves. And you know it happens when the wolves get hold of the flock. In this protocol, they go into further detail about destroying the last vestiges of our type of government and replacing it with their Jewish world order, which will come in the form of a revolution of the state. As a precondition of this new world order, many combinations of concepts, which we now accept, such as freedom of the press, right of association, freedom of conscience, the voting principle, and many others, must disappear forever from the memory of man. The Jews want to make sure that when they spring the final closing of the jaws on the Goyim, such victims must recognize once and for all that they, the Jews, are so strong, so superabundantly filled with power, that in no case will they take account of any protest, nor will they pay any attention whatsoever to the opinions or wishes of the Goyim. And they want to impress upon us that they are ready and able to crush with irresistible power all expressions of such protest at any moment and at every place. In fear and trembling, the Goyim will close his eyes to everything and be content to wait and see how it will all end. In the meantime, the Jews will keep the Goyim Gentiles pacified by promising to give back to them all the liberties they have taken away as soon as they have quelled the enemies of peace. Why are they doing this? In order to obtain, in a roundabout way, that which their scattered tribe would be unable to obtain by direct methods. That is why they have organized an army of Masonic lodges to throw a smokescreen over their real aims, which are not even so much as suspected by these Goy cattle. God has granted us, his chosen people, the gift of dispersion, and in which appears in all eyes to be our weakness, has come forth all our strength, which has now brought us to the threshold of sovereignty over all the world. Literature and journalism are regarded by the Jews as the two most important educative forces, and therefore they want to make sure that their government will become the sole proprietor of the majority of all journals. They regard freedom of the press, or freedom as such, as the right to do only that which the law allows. Since they are going to create or abolish such laws as are desirable to them, all freedom will be in their hands. Propaganda and the press, which creates it, are therefore regarded as a key to control all the Goyim. We shall saddle and bridle it with a tight curb. We shall do the same also with all productions of the printing press. Anybody in the printing business will be required to have a stamp tax and deposits of caution money. If anybody attacks the Jews, if such is still possible, we will inflict fines without mercy. They intend to so straddle the press that no one shall with impunity lift a finger on the correctness and infallibility of their government. They will also establish magazines and papers of their own that will make phony attacks upon their Jewish establishment, but of course they will be limited to such trivial points that will cause them no problem. They will be labor 100 sides of every point, but never bringing up any real issues until they have the public so confused that they won't know where they stand or what a valid opinion even is. In any case, not a single announcement will reach the public without going through the control of the Jews. The Goyim will look upon events of the world through the colored spectacles which we are setting astride their noses. They brag that even now, and this was written over 70 years ago, there is no state secret that the Jews don't have access to. Now, 70 years later, we can imagine how much further they are in control. The future despotic Jewish state will have 3 classes of journals that they will control. In the front rank will stand the organs of an official character. These journals will always stand guard over the Jewish interests, and they will admit that, therefore, their influence will be comparatively small. In the second rank will be the semi-official organs, whose part it will be to attract the tepid and indifferent goyim. In the third rank they will set up their own papers, but to all appearances will be in opposition to their regime. This will A. trap their real opponents to accept this simulated opposition as their own. B. They can lead the opposition opinion into the very channels to which they then desire, and thereby neutralize them. In this way, they will carry on their own sham fights, which will confound and confuse the goyim. At the same time, the goyim will still be under the illusion that he is enjoying freedom of the press. Even at the time that the protocols were written, the Jews bragged that with the French press, all organs of the press are bound together by professional secrecy. No journalist would venture to betray this secret, because not one of them is ever admitted to practice literature unless his past has some disgraceful episode with which the Jews could thereby blackmail and control that member of the press. When the Jews have finally accomplished their world goal, and have the despotic regime in full control, they intend to make sure that there will be no revelations by the press of any public dishonesty. The new regime must be thought of to have so perfectly satisfied everybody that even criminality will seem to have disappeared. Protocol number 12, subject headings only. This chapter is rather long and deals with the tremendously important role of the Jewish-created Masonic orders and Masonic lodges play in control of the press, government, and the Gentiles as a whole. Masonic interpretation of the word freedom, future of the press in the Masonic kingdom, control of the press, correspondence agencies. What is progress as understood by Masonry? More about the press. Masonic solidarity in the press of today, the arousing of public demands in the provinces, infallibility of the new regime.
Protocol number 13. The need for our daily bread will be the most powerful club the Jews intend to wield over the head of the goyim, to keep him in silence as their humble servant. They will use their Gentile agents of the press to discuss those issues that are inconvenient for their official journals to mention. The Jewish-controlled regime will then simply take and carry through such measures as they wish and then offer them to the public as an accomplished fact. Once done, no one will dare to demand a change in the matter, and all the more so since the Jewish press will then represent their new measures as a great improvement. Immediately thereafter, the press will distract the current thought towards new and frivolous questions. As the goyim people become more and more enslaved, the Jews intend to further distract them with amusements, games, pastimes, passions, people's palaces, and many other distractions such as competitions in art and sports of all kinds. The Jewish-controlled press alone will guide the people to any and all forms of opinion, which the people will then regard as their own, because they, the Jews, will have all monopoly in offering them any new directions for thought. Liberals and utopian dreamers will play their part in wrecking the remnants of the Goy government
until the Jews take over. After that, these liberals will be of absolutely no value to them. In fact, they may even be dangerous, and they will have to be set aside. Although they will upset our whole white civilization and turn society upside down, their orators will expound at great length on how they have now enslaved us. Who will ever suspect, then, that all these peoples were stage-managed by us according to a political plan, which no one has so much guessed at in the course of many centuries? Protocol number 14. When the Jews have established their despotic kingdom, they intend to make sure that no other religion will exist, that their religion, the religion of Moses, in which they will stand out as the chosen people, all other forms of belief will be swept away. They will then delude the Goyim that in their religion there exists a mystical rite on which all educational power is based. After they have enslaved all the peoples of the world and imposed their tyrannical regime upon them, they will then at every possible opportunity publish articles and make comparisons between their benevolent rule and those of the past ages. They will extol the blessings of tranquility, although that tranquility was forcibly brought about by centuries of Jewish agitation. The errors of previous Goyim governments will be denounced by the Jews in the most forceful language. All the useless changes of forms of government through which they have run the Goyim when they were undermining their state structures will so have wearied the peoples that finally they will prefer to suffer anything under the Jews rather than run the risk of enduring again all those agitations and miseries. When they are in full power, they will further emphasize again all the historical mistakes that their previous Goy government made for so many centuries by their lack of understanding of everything that constitutes the true good of humanity. In contrast, they will expound to them how fortunate the people now are in contrast to the dead and decomposed old order of things. In countries known as progressive and enlightened, the Jews admit that it was they themselves that created a senseless, filthy, and abominable literature. Yet this will later be brought out as a charge and discredit to the old order. No one will ever be allowed to bring under discussion the Jewish faith from its true point of view. No one but the Jews will be fully instructed and fully learned in its contents. None of the chosen will ever dare to betray any of its secrets, nor how it was used to enslave the rest of humanity. Protocol number 15. Subject headings only. One day coup d'etat, revolution over all the world. Executions. Future lot of the Goyim Masons. Mysticism of authority. Multiplication of Masonic lodges. Central governing board of Masonic elders. The Azev tactics. Masonry as leader and guide of all secret societies. Significance of public applause. Collectivism. Victims, executions of Masons, fall of prestige, of laws and authority, our position as the chosen people, brevity and clarity of the laws of our kingdom of the future, obedience to orders, measures against abuse of authority, severity of penalties, age limit for judges, liberalism of judges and authorities, the money of all the world, absolutism of Masonry, right of appeal, patriarchal, outside appearance, of the power of the one and only right, the King of Israel, patriarch of all the world. Protocol number 16. Realizing that the universities are the key institutions forming and molding the thought of the people, the Jews plan to emasculate the universities by reorienting them in a new direction, one that is useful to the Jews. All officials and professors will have detailed programs prepared for them from which they will proceed to teach, and not be allowed to diverge in the slightest. They will be selected with care, and be put into such a position they will be wholly dependent upon the government. No meaningful courses in the study of state law or political questions will be given, except to a few dozen carefully selected persons, chosen for their special abilities and coming from the ranks of their Jewish brethren. During the transitional period, while they are still struggling for absolute despotism, the Jews will introduce into the education programs all those divisive principles that have been used so brilliantly to break upon the order of the Goyim governments. But once they are completely in power, they plan to remove every kind of disturbing subject from the course of education. Instead, they will make the young people obedient children of authority, loving him who rules, giving him support, and hoping for peace and quiet. The study of classics, the study of ancient history, and the lessons of past experience will be replaced with theoretical studies of programs for the future. We shall erase from the memory of man all facts of previous centuries which are undesirable to us, and leave only those which depict all the errors of the government of the Goyim. Special emphasis will be placed on the study of practical life, the obligations of the people to the state, and to law and order. Each different trade and faction will be given a special and different treatment, in order that the despotic Jewish king will be more firmly seated in control. It will be necessary that all his activities be relayed to the nation as a whole, in the schools and on the marketplaces, in such a manner that the people will have a clear understanding of all his acts and his many and great benevolent accomplishments. There will be no such thing as freedom of instruction. Special groups will be taught in the philosophy of new theories which have not been declared to the rest of the world. These theories will be in the nature of a dogma of faith and used as a transitional stage in initiating the people towards their faith, i.e., the Jewish faith. They observe that the experience of many centuries has taught them that people live and are guided by ideas, and that these ideas are absorbed by people only through education. All different ages are equally receptive to ideas. The end result strived for in the so-called system of teaching will be to turn the Goyim into unthinking, submissive brutes, waiting for things to be presented before their eyes in order to form any idea at all. Protocol number 17, subject headings only. Special training of their own attorneys. Future attorneys paid by state. Information used by attorneys limited to that provided by state. King of the Jews will be the real Pope of the universe, the Patriarch of the International Church. Destruction of existing church when it has served its purpose. Function of the contemporary press. Organization of police. Volunteer police. Espionage on the pattern of cabal espionage, abusing and degrading Goyim authority. Protocol number 18. Realizing that nothing damages the prestige of authority more than it obviously being surrounded by a mass of secret police forces for its own protection, they plan to protect their Jewish despotism by more devious means. They will set up conspiracies of their own among the people, led by brilliant speakers who will gather around them all those sympathetic to their protest of opposition against the regime. In this way, they will be able to remove weak and wavering members among their own police force, and also be able to round up the potential opposition that might develop by natural means. This way, they will be able to nip in the bud and root out any conspiracies before they even get started. It is a measure of weakness for too many conspiracies to be known among the people and to compel the rulers to acknowledge their weakness in advertising their secret measures of defense. Similarly, if several attempts upon the lives of the rulers are known, this too weakens the prestige and their authority over those being ruled. The Jews frankly admit that they have instigated any number of assassinations and attempts at assassinations of kings and rulers in the past. They thereby help to destroy the authority of the whole Goyim government by undermining the idea of absolute authority and encouraging the idea that underneath lies a vast opposition. When the supreme Jewish king of the world is in power, they plan to reinforce his protection by creating such an aura of power and mystical deity about him that the poor, stupid Goyim will think of him as being next to a god. The Goyim will then do everything possible to protect him and to inform authorities of any opposition that might lie anywhere among his subjects. Political criminals will be dealt with extreme cruelty. They will be arrested on the first suspicion, whether it's well-grounded or not. No opportunity will be given of escape of people even suspected of political crime. And in these matters, they intend to be completely merciless. Why, anybody even thinking about political ideas is already guilty of a crime. For he should have no understanding of it in the first place, and secondly, he should not be occupying himself with such matters. Protocol number 19. No dabbling in political affairs that will have any meaning whatsoever will be allowed among the subjects, or shall we say, the victims of the Jewish regime. The Jews point out that under a well-organized, powerful government, for any individual or groups of individuals to make any attempt at what they call sedition mongering is about as significant as a lapdog yapping at an elephant. So no individual will get the idea of being a hero and leading the people to opposition. All individuals who make such attempts will be put to trial in the same category as thieving, murder, or any other kind of abominable and filthy crime. This will disgrace these heroic people in the eyes of the public, and they will be branded with the same contempt as they might hold for any low criminal. In any case, everything will be done to completely wipe out any possibility of sedition or opposition. In the past, to break down Goyim regimes, they have inserted into history books the idea of heroism and martyrdom of those who have opposed the Goyim governments. This will be completely changed and wiped out when their Jewish regime has been established. The average citizen will have no more influence or control in the affairs of politics than will a herd of cattle. Protocol number 20. The sum total of our actions is settled by the question of figures. By this the Jews mean money, and that money controls everything. Protocol number 20 is a long and complicated one, having mostly to do with money, taxation, and interest. It lays out the blueprint for their fiscal policies, when the king of the world rules supreme. In the first place, the Jewish king will enjoy the legal fiction that everything in his state belongs to him. They state in parentheses, this may very well be a fact. He will then therefore have the legal power to confiscate any and every kind of sums on whatever pretext he may choose. The Jews blatantly boast that economic crises have been produced by them for the destruction of the Goyim by very simple means, the withdrawal of money from circulation. They admit that they have burdened the finances of the state with huge loans on which they obtain huge sums of interest,
and made them the bond slaves of their international bankers. They further boast that the concentration of all industry in the hands of their Jewish capitalists and out of the hands of the small masters has drained away all the strength of the peoples, along with the strength of the state. The Jews point with pride to the fact that the gold standard has been the ruin of the states which have adopted it, for it has not been able to satisfy the demands for money, the more so as they drain the gold from circulation. The reader should remember that this was written prior to 1900, and then recall, in 1933, the Jews first of all took all the gold away from the American public and made it a crime of an American citizen to own gold. By now, they have shipped practically all the gold we had in Fort Knox out of the country. The little that the United States has left is now overcommitted and overobligated. We are now completely plundered and devoid of any gold. They pat themselves on the back for their ingenuity and cunning compared to the purely brute brains of the goyim. They boast that with their clever banking system, the goyim has been borrowing from them with payment of interest without ever thinking that all the same, all the money that they have been paying interest on had come from their own state pockets in order to pay them these huge amounts of interest. As long as the loans were internal, the goyim rarely shuffled their money from the pockets of the poor to those of the very rich. But this changed when it came to borrowing from foreign sources. What it then amounted to was that the wealth of this country flowed into the cash boxes of the Jews, and the goyim was rarely paying tribute to the Jews as subjects or slaves. This is all part of their master plan. Without a definite plan, it is impossible to rule. Marching along an undetermined road and with undetermined resources brings to ruin, by the way, heroes and demigods. And so, in accordance with the plan, the poor goyim hardly realizes what a state of financial disaster he is now in, despite the astonishing industry and productivity of their people. Protocol number 21. Having grasped absolute control of all the money systems of the different states of the world, and having a monopoly on banking and credit, the Jews now brag that they get their money twice, three times, and more times over by lending it to the Goy government. They frankly admit that most of the time the Goy governments have no business and no need for making these loans. However, by means of bribery of the state officials and the slackness of the Goy rulers themselves, they have now lured them into the position where they are all hopelessly deluged with an overwhelming sum of debt. Not only do they have to borrow more money every year, but they have to borrow money to even pay the interest on the mountains of debt that they have piled upon the stupid Goy. But when the Jews ascend the throne of the world, all these financial shifts that do not serve their interests will be swept aside so as not to leave a trace. Money markets will be destroyed, and they will not allow the prestige of their government to be shaken by any fluctuations of prices, but they, the Jews, shall announce by law values and prices. They shall replace the money markets by grandiose government credit institutions, the object of which will be to fix the price of industrial values in accordance with whatever the government determines. This will make all industrial undertakings become completely dependent upon the Jews, and they arrogantly add, "You may imagine for yourselves what immense power we shall thereby secure for ourselves." Protocol number 22. The ultimate goal for which the Jews are striving is further defined and clarified in this protocol. In our hands is the greatest power of our day, gold. When we consider that these words were written at least 70 years ago, and look at the picture today of how they have plundered and looted the reserves of gold of the different peoples of the world. Today, we are beginning to get a pretty fair idea of the success of their master plan. Arrogantly, they then point to the fact that, having accumulated all this wealth, isn't this surely proof that their rule is predestined by God? Though much violence will be necessary, nevertheless, they are determined that their fiendish and diabolical rule will be established. Having once done so, they will contrive to prove that they are the benefactors who have restored freedom, order, and tranquility to a confused and strife-torn world. Our authority will be glorious, because it will be all-powerful, will rule and guide, and not muddle along after leaders and orators shrieking themselves hoarse with senseless words, which they call great principles. Their authority, they vow, will be the crown of order, and will have about it an aura of deity that will inspire a mystical bowing of the knee before it, and a reverent fear before it, of all the peoples. True force makes no terms with any right, not even with that of God. None dare come near to it, so as to take so much as a span from it away. Protocol number 23, reducing all people to abject slavery and bending them to their supreme authority, is the main thread that runs through all the protocols. One more way is to inculcate lessons of humility, that is to make people more humble, and therefore they will be more obedient. Remember the Sermon on the Mount. By reducing the production of luxury articles and depriving the people of all forms of luxuries, they will force them to become more humble and therefore more obedient. Furthermore, they will undermine and reduce large manufacturers to a people of small masters and small units. This is a return back to the Middle Ages. Drunkenness will also be prohibited by law and will be punishable as a crime. Whereas the Jews have stirred up dissension, revolution, and the fire of anarchy all over the world, when the chosen one of God, that is their Jewish king, is on the throne, then all these agitators will have played their parts. Having served their usefulness, they will then be liquidated. Then it will be necessary to sweep them away from his path, on which must be left no knot, no splinter. All this to bring about ruin, and to erect on those ruins, finally, the throne of the King of the Jews. Protocol number 24. The coming King of the world and the King of the Jews must have his ancestral lineage confirmed in the dynastic roots of King David. He will evidently be selected and sponsored by three of the highest elders of Zion. He will be most carefully selected, not by any right of heritage, but by sheer outstanding ability. Then follows a most intensive and rigorous training of their future king by those elders that are on the inside to familiarize him with all their secrets of the Jewish Zionist program. The king will then be inducted into the most secret mysteries of the political, into the schemes of government, and into the whole program. All these secrets, nevertheless, will be strictly kept within a very limited inner circle. The king will not necessarily be followed by direct heirs, but his heirs will be screened for ability. Only those who are unconditionally capable of firm, even though it be cruel, direct rule, will be allowed to take over the reins of government from the learned elders. In case the king falls sick, or displays weakness of will, or any other form of incapacity, he must by law hand over the reins of law to new and capable hands. Once he is on the throne, only the king and the three elders who stood sponsor for him will know what the program for the future will be. None will know what the king wishes to attain by his disposition, and therefore
None will dare stand across an unknown path. The king of the Jews must be devoid of all feelings and passion, and must exercise the cold reasoning power of his superior mind. The prop of humanity, in the person of the supreme lord of all the world, of the holy seed of David, must sacrifice to his people all personal inclinations.